Welcome, welcome from Alpha, from Alpha to Omega. To Omega.
Hello, and welcome to the 47th episode of From Alpha to Omega. Today is Saturday, the 15th of March, 2014, and I'm your host, Tom O'Brien. This week's show is brought to you by the generous repeat donation of Michael T. Thanking you, Michael. If you too would like to send your children's inheritance my way, why not click on that there donate button on the podcast website? This week, I am delighted to have Professor Andrew Kleiman back on the show to talk about his latest book, The Failure of Capitalist Production. The book is a brilliant example of empirical economic research and really shows how relevant and insightful Marx's work still is in helping us understand the workings of our capitalist economy. So Andrew, I've recently just finished your book, The Failure of Capitalist Production, which I must say is an absolute tour de force of empirical economic research. How long did it take to put together, and where did you source all these statistics from?
Well, thank you very much, Tom, and thank you for inviting me onto your podcast. I did not set out to write a book. I just kind of stumbled on something, and the more I began to investigate, and people would ask me questions, I'd investigate more, and I found out so much that was surprising, and it leads to just a different understanding of what took place for 30 years. You know, in the end, I had a book. The process took 2 years. I was teaching, so it wasn't 2 years full time. Most of my statistics come from either the National Accounting Agency of the United States, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the folks who put out gross domestic product statistics and so forth, or from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, also part of the Department of Labor of the U.S. government.
The main thesis of the book is, I suppose, trying to demonstrate that the crisis we are in is a crisis caused by the underlying fragility of the system, which is caused by a prolonged fall in the rate of profit, Marx's tendential fall in the rate of profit. How did the statistics bear up?
Well, the actual process is the reverse. I looked at what happened and then I drew up the thesis. So I didn't start out with a hypothesis or any claim to prove. But what I found very early on in my research, which led me to continue, and I found that the rate of profit of U.S. corporations, specifically their rate of return on their investment in fixed capital, fixed assets like factory buildings, offices, shopping malls, machinery, computer systems, all of that, I found that their rate of return on their fixed assets, the rate of profit, did fall. It was very high at the start of the post-World War II period from about 1955 onward. After that, it begins to fall. And what was surprising was that under the period of so-called neoliberalism, from the 80s onward, there was not a recovery in that rate of profit.
Now, before we get into the exact details of the analysis, probably need to mention a little bit about the controversy between Marx's economists on what is the correct way to measure the rate of profit. We've dealt with this before in a previous episode with yourself on the transformation problem, if people would like to check it out in detail. But in a nutshell, how would you describe the differing arguments?
Let me begin in a kind of roundabout way. I don't think it's a measurement issue. In other words, we have a measurement issue when we have some given object that exists independently of our concepts. And for instance, it might be the distance between the Earth and Alpha Centauri. And different people will produce different measures because they have different assumptions. Maybe they have different apparatus, different equipment. And so you can get some disagreement and controversy about exactly the procedures and the apparatus to use to measure the distance between the Earth and Alpha Centauri. Nothing like that takes place with the rate of profit. It's a concept. So what one is measuring is one's trying to specify what are the numbers according to one's own concept. And so there are really two basic concepts at play here. One is that the rate of profit is the rate of return on investment. Profit as a percentage of the total amount of money that has been invested, for instance, in the business for the acquisition of the fixed capital, minus, of course, all depreciation. You know, machines wear out, they depreciate, and the depreciation costs get figured into the price of the product. And so when the products are sold, that's a recovery of some of the investment. So you net that out. So it's the accumulated investment minus depreciation. And you're saying, how big is profit compared to that accumulated investment net of depreciation? That's one concept. That's the concept basically that business people employ. That's the concept investors employ. That's the concept I think Marx was working with, and that's the concept that I work with. What has been done traditionally in studies of movements in the rate of profit is not that, for a variety of reasons, one of which is that the statistics were either not available or not readily available, but there are other reasons as well. The other conception is what is profit as a percentage of the replacement cost of the fixed capital, which is to say, what is profit as a percentage of the amount of money that it would take today if the firm were to replace all of its fixed assets with the same kind of assets? So it's the current cost of the replacement cost of the fixed assets. It's a different concept. I don't really understand what that concept is. Sometimes it gets justified by saying that profit, as a percentage of this replacement cost or current cost is the expected rate of profit. But that's actually not the case. And I don't really know of any other real justification for measuring profit relative to the current cost or replacement cost of the fixed assets.
Do neoclassical economists measure profit the normal way, or do they use this other way of measuring it?
In actual fact, they don't tend to do much in the way of measuring the rate of profit in terms of empirical statistics. It's very important, but most of the measurement we get, for instance, among the forecasters, deals with data that are readily available immediately. And this stuff is not readily available immediately because the figures for fixed assets, for instance, those figures only come out once a year. And with a delay. So only a few months ago did we get figures for 2013. I would say it depends on the particular context, what people are considering theoretically among neoclassical economists and among other economists as well. The basic underlying concept is supposed to be, in general, the first of the two that I mentioned to you. Profit as a percentage of the funds that have been invested.
In the book, you mentioned some empirical investigation you did to see which type of profit rate correlates best with predicting price earning ratio of stocks. What does this show?
Basically, I just ran simple regressions correlation between the rate of return in equities, the stock market rate of return, and the rates of profit that I had measured. And when you look at the rate of profit as a percentage of the actual funds invested, you could say that a little over a third of the variation in stock market rates of return is attributable in terms of movements in the rate of profit. If you use the other conception of the rate of profit as a percentage of what it would take to replace all of the fixed capital, there's essentially no correlation at all. The movements in the one have nothing to do with movements in the other. Those are interesting results. The only conclusion that I'm willing to draw from it is that the first way of measuring the rate of profit is more closely related to what actual businesses and investors care about and mean by profitability. For instance, a different way of measuring profitability, which is purely financial and isn't directly related to production, is the rate of return on equity. And so that's what I was looking at there. What is the relationship between the rate of return in production and the rate of return measured on the basis of equity. And with one measure of the rate of profit, the first one, you get some positive relationship. With the other one, you do not.
The current cost rate of profit, this is the second type, also lowers the rate of profit in inflationary times and reduces it in disinflationary times. Can you explain this and what the relevance of this is?
Right. Well, the current cost rate of profit will be, in general, lower. Because with inflation, the current cost of your machinery and factory buildings and office buildings is greater than the actual amount of money you paid for them. But that's not really the issue. The real issue is, what does this do to the trend in the rate of profit? In other words, one could be higher than the other. They could both trend upward or downward to the same extent. And this is, however, where inflation plays a strange role. When you have increasing inflation and acceleration of inflation, that tends to depress the current cost, so-called rate of profit, because the capital is increasing especially fast. The profit is being measured against a base that's rising especially fast compared to measure of the rate of profit that measures it against the actual amount invested. And when we have disinflation, a decline in the rate of inflation, such as we had in the early 1980s, especially in the U.S. after the Volcker shock and the recessions of the early 80s, the rate of inflation comes way down. That tends to reduce the current cost of the fixed capital. And as a result, it tends to boost the second measure of profitability, the current cost, so-called rate of profit. The claim made by the proponents of that second measure that you had a rise in the rate of profit under neoliberalism is pretty much traceable wholly to not the smashing of the unions and stagnation of wages. It's pretty much attributable to that disinflation of the early 80s, which tended to boost that rate of profit a great deal. But after, I think, 84 or 85, that effect kind of peters out, and there really was not any continued rise in the rate of profit for the most part after that.
Just to see if I have this right. So if I'm a business, say, and I have some machinery or something, in a period of high inflation, now the cost of replacing that machinery after things have inflated is probably a lot higher than what I paid for it. So under the current cost, then the profit you have would be much lower. But then when the price of the machinery starts to maybe taper off, when there's disinflation, it becomes cheaper to buy that machinery, and therefore your profit is bigger.
As long as prices are rising, it will always be the case that it's going to cost you more to replace the fixed capital than the amount that you actually paid for it when you invested in the past. But when we have inflation increasing, that effect becomes more pronounced. And when we have disinflation, inflation subsiding, that effect becomes less pronounced. And that's what's movement in that current cost rate of profit. So when inflation is accelerating, their rate of profit tends to fall. And when inflation is subsiding, their rate of profit tends to rise. And so, for instance, people who use that measure always claimed that the economic crisis of the mid-70s was directly due to a fall in the rate of profit. But what actually happened is this: both the crisis and the fall in the rate of profit are attributable to a third cause, which was the rise in oil prices. So the rise in oil prices triggers a recession, massive recession in the US and Europe. And at the same time, because of that inflation, their rate of profit went down. By the way, it's peculiar to think that a rise in the rate of inflation will lower your rate of profit, because if there's more inflation, you're getting higher prices for the stuff that you as a business sell compared to what you've invested. So you've invested 100, and if there were no inflation, let's say you'd sell stuff for 10. And so your profit from the stuff you sell would be 10. So you'd have 10 over 100, or 10% as your rate of profit. If you have inflation, the profit from what you sell might be 15%. So you would think that as inflation accelerates, that should tend to boost the measured rate of profit. Not that that's a measure of a healthy economy, but their rate of profit, so-called, works the other way.
You say yes.
You've sold me on the historical rate of profit is the better one to use. I would recommend people, if they want to learn more, to read the book. So what could we say was your helicopter view of how the rate of profit performed in the US since the Great Depression?
I'm not quite sure what a helicopter view is. You mean looking at it over the whole in the long term? Well, the rate of profit fell in the first part of the post-war period and did not recover thereafter. And since I completed the book, the Bureau of Economic Analysis has revised its measures in a substantial comprehensive revision last year. And as a result of its new concepts, what we get is even more of a downward trend in the rate of profit from the early 80s onward. Whereas when I did the statistics for my book, some measures of the rate of profit that use rather narrow definitions of profit, they kind of flattened out during that period from the 80s up to the Great Recession. Under the new conception of the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the rate of profit, even when profit measured rather narrowly, the rate of profit continues to trend downward. What becomes clear is if you just look at the low points or troughs, all of the measures of the rate of profit that I look at, you get a clear decline from low point to low point to low point to low point in all of the measures of the rate of profit. Okay, so they just trend downward, whereas according to the previous way that the BEA measured these things, when you use the narrower definitions of profit, they just kind of like were trendless, these rates of profit.
So one stat that jumped out at me in the book was how you found that all the increase of US Treasury debt to GDP ratio can be explained by the falling profitability of US corporations and reductions in the corporation tax. That seems like a very strong statistic.
Yeah, I think it is. I was rather shocked by that. But I mean, there are two factors there. The profitability fell. And secondly, government policy is very important to understand the Great Recession and what led up to it. Government policy is very important in a number of ways. And one of the things that happened was a very large reduction in corporate income tax, profit tax in the United States due to less profitability, due to less revenue coming into the government because they're lowering the tax on profitability. Those two factors combined account for all of the rise in the ratio of Treasury debt to gross domestic product prior to, of course, 2008, up to the Great Recession. What that does mean is we've had, you know, some calls for austerity. U.S. policy since the Great Recession has not been austerity oriented like it has been in Germany or the U.K., but it could conceivably have been a lot more expansionary than it has been if, for instance, the ratio of Treasury debt to GDP started off prior to the recession at 33% instead of 66, 67% as it did.
Now, you also found that if corporation tax was kept at previous levels, that after tax rate of profit would have dropped from nearly 8% to just over 3%.
That's, I believe, a computation for a specific year, 2001. In other words, I was just at that point trying to indicate the severity of the fall in the rate of profit between 1997, which was a temporary high point, 2001, in the context of trying to understand the severity of the situation that the U.S. economy faced at the start of the last decade, well, well prior to the Great Recession, financial panic, and even prior to most of the buildup of the home price bubble. That's important to understand in order to understand the reaction to that on the part of the Federal Reserve and how, by reacting with very easy money policy, stimulative expansionary monetary policy, the Fed papered over the problems temporarily. So it looked like just a pure effect of the home price bubble, but it also tended to perpetuate and inflate that bubble even further, so that when the crisis did break out, it was much worse than it would have been. It's in the context of understanding the prelude to the easy money policies of the Fed that I talked about that sharp fall in the rate of profit.
So what caused the rate of profit to drop over this long period? What does the empirical evidence show?
Right. What caused the rate of profit to fall? I mean, this is very hard to say. What people typically do, and I do in the book, is to decompose the rate of profit, break it down into various factors, and look at how they moved. But I performed a decomposition that is different from the normal type. I also present the normal type. But basically, I said one reason that the rate of profit could fall is if the workers are doing better at the expense of profits. That didn't happen. Pretty much the ratio of profits to employee compensation was stable all throughout this period. It fell a little bit in the early part of the post-war period, but was flat after 1970. Another reason why the rate of profit could fall is if the tendency for prices to rise in relationship to the amount of labor it takes to produce commodities, or Marx's language, if the rate of increase in prices over values tends to subside. Okay. If that had happened, that would have also tended to depress the rate of profit. But over the long haul, that did not happen either. So two of those factors that you can separate out that could influence the rate of profit really had almost no influence on the rate of profit. Now, what is left when you abstract from them, which you can do because they hardly changed at all, is a ratio of employment to capital advanced. So the fall in the rate of profit means that the advance of capital, or the investment of capital, grew faster than employment grew.
This is the idea of, say, more machinery or capital stock of buildings and stuff growing in ratio to the number of employees.
Yes. Underlying it is the process of technical innovation that's so-called capital intensive, or labor saving. You know, mechanization, robotization, automation. It's not directly that, because we're measuring the money value of the capital, not the physical capital. But underlying that process is automation, mechanization, robotization. So that process, as mediated through also money prices, that is what tended over the long haul to reduce the rate of profit. Over 90% of the fall in the rate of profit of U.S. corporations from the start of the post-war period to the Great Recession is attributable to that. And this is Marx's law of the tendential fall in the rate of profit, the tendency for capital to accumulate faster than employment grows.
And what role did the IT revolution play in this?
Well, it probably played a big part. It's kind of hard to say, you know, counterfactually, if IT hadn't come along, would they still have invested, you know, in the way that they did invest? I don't know. One thing that the IT revolution did, which is a rather technical matter, is it led to more rapid rates of depreciation. And that plays a funny role in terms of the measurement of the rate of profit. when you look at Marx's conception of depreciation versus the U.S. government's, the Bureau of Economic Analysis concept of depreciation, it gets rather complex. But the IT revolution led to more rapid depreciation because, well, software is said to have an average life of 3 years. And computer systems, you know, the hardware, a very short service life of like 5 years. And most equipment has a lifetime of 7 or 8 years, sometimes much longer than that. But on average, that's about it. So this IT stuff, software and hardware, depreciates much more rapidly. And so with the companies investing bigger and bigger share of their total investment in that, the overall rate of depreciation went up. And that affects the rate of profit. It affects a lot of statistics, actually, for instance, the gross domestic product. So, for instance, we've seen recently something that's not directly related, but it's actually important in this context. And they say, well, the worker's share of GDP has declined, the worker's share of the gross domestic product. Well, that's true, but that is purely due to a rise in the depreciation share of the GDP. So the worker share of the GDP hasn't fallen because the profit share has gone up. The profit share of gross domestic product has also gone down, and both have fallen at the expense of the rising depreciation share.
So this new IT equipment, because new, faster versions come out so often, it causes the existing stock to depreciate more, and this is an added cost into the whole productive economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is a deadweight cost like that. There are investments that really do not get recouped. You know, you buy software for $1,000 and 3 years later, it's worthless, right? You know, or a computer system. I mean, I would really like to know what the costs of this that don't get recouped are. And I did my best to kind of give a sense of that, being able to provide a precise measure of that.
If profits are dropping in the US, what about the profits of multinational companies? Are they able to hold their profit rates up by exploiting cheap labor abroad?
No, they weren't. I have a little bit of discussion of that in my book for the following reason. There are two sets of accounts, or there's several actually, but when I talked about the rate of profit of US corporations falling, all of that comes from the domestic accounts. We're just looking at corporations operating in the United States. Then there are the profits of U.S. multinationals from subsidiaries abroad that they either wholly own or partly own. And those are in separate accounts. So I had to look at them separately because they're from separate accounts. But the rate of return on foreign direct investment of the U.S. multinationals also fell during the period for which there are data, the early 80s to the Great Recession. This seems very surprising because a much, much greater share of these corporations' total profit has been coming from abroad. The problem is that so much more of their investment to generate that profit is going abroad, and the profit gained from abroad did not rise as rapidly as the investment abroad. So the rate of return, the profit as a percentage of the investment abroad, shows a clear declining path.
Now, where is the majority of their investment going? Is it going into developing countries or is it going into other Western countries?
I did not do much work on this when I wrote my book. After I published the book, I did more work on it. There was a paper I published, and one can find it online. And it's actually very difficult to say because there's one issue of where the production takes place and where the physical assets are located and where people are employed. That could be one country and often is one country where the country of ownership of the foreign subsidiary is quite different. In other words, it might be, you know, some small country and nothing is located there except a post office box where the corporation is incorporated. Production might be taking place in China. It might be taking place in Malaysia. What I can tell from the statistics that we do have is a much bigger share of U.S. multinationals' production and employment is located in third world countries such as China than we would see if we were to look at where the profits are coming from in terms of the country of ownership of where the subsidiary is incorporated. The problem is the statistics don't go far back enough in terms of the physical location of the assets and the employment to really say that much. So one really has to use the country of incorporation to get a long enough time series to talk about rates of return on foreign direct investment. But I did look at that in country after country, and there was pretty much a generalized fall in all of the countries where U.S. companies have subsidiaries specified in terms of ownership, with only a few exceptions, and those exceptions are tax havens, where through various means, profits that are being produced elsewhere are shifted into those countries in order not to have to pay such high taxes.
So does this mean that this falling rate of profit could be a global phenomenon?
What I argue in the paper is that it seems to me that this evidence is kind of coincidentally the best evidence for a fall in the global rate of profit. There are no global rate of profit statistics. And very hard even to, I haven't even attempted it, to get any kind of what I would regard as meaningful measures of the rate of profit for various countries. But if the rate of profit of U.S. multinationals is falling here, there, the other place, all throughout the world, which it did, then it seems very plausible that the rate of profit of other companies was also falling here, there, everywhere, all throughout the world. There's no reason to think that U.S. multinationals in a particular country are going to experience rates of return on their investment that are different than domestic companies or foreign companies from other countries. So the fact that the multinationals of the U.S. are getting profitability that's trending downward throughout this period in a whole variety of countries seems to me to be really strong evidence that the rate of return of companies globally fell. And, you know, I also looked, for instance, was this because U.S. multinationals, a lot of them are in the financial sector? Is it because a lot of them disproportionately are in the manufacturing sector? And that didn't account for too much. So I couldn't find anything particular about U.S. multinationals make their rates of profit in country after country fall. As a result, I'm inclined to believe, not having any direct evidence, I'm inclined to believe that the global rate of profit fell during this period as well, from the early 80s onward.
One thing I was very interested in finding in the book is how you described the statistical evidence for the amount of destruction of capital that took place during the Great Depression.
Well, the most striking finding, U.S. corporations' fixed capital in investment from 1929 until pretty much the end of World War II only increased by 3%.
So this means that the amount of investment, the money that was being invested in the economy, only grew by 3% during this period.
Right. The total amount of money invested only grew by 3%. And by the end of the war, World War II, production had picked up. And so the ratio of gross domestic product to the corporation's capital investment was about double what it was, I think, in 1929. I don't remember the figures offhand. It was something like that.
So this massive destruction of capital value, can you explain the process of how this would have occurred?
You know, what happened to the fixed capital of corporations is a part of the process. I don't think it's the major part of the process. So there's destruction of fixed capital in the sense of the means of production, the capital, fixed capital, depreciating, not being replaced. But the financial and monetary aspects, I think, are more significant. The Dow Jones Index during the Depression fell, I think, by 91%. You know, so if you had bought a share of stock for $100, it was worth $9 at the low point. Consumer prices fell by about 25%. Prices of fixed assets fell by a similar percentage. I give a figure from Irving Fisher of debt deflation fame. I don't remember what it was, but it was something similar in terms of the total destruction of wealth in the U.S. measured in money terms from 29 to 1932 or 1933. And the key thing about this destruction of capital is, of course, that is the crisis. That is the downturn in the economy, but it provides a means, an internal means, endogenous means, for capitalism to rebound, because new owners can buy companies that have failed. You know, debts are not being repaid. Companies fail. New owners can buy those companies very cheaply, and they don't have to assume the debts. They don't have to pay the debts of the other owners who have been wiped out. So even if the amount of profit that they can get isn't very high, it's relatively high compared to the amount that the new owners have to invest. So that is one factor that helps to lead to, you know, the next upturn in capitalism, the next boom. And I think that is part of the explanation for why capitalism, you know, did rebound from the Depression and then after the war.
So what has been the fate of workers amid all of this falling of profit?
I should say I centered my analysis on the U.S., first of all, just because the depth of statistics is far superior to any other country. So if you want to do an in-depth data analysis, you pretty much have to focus on the U.S., and actually everybody does who does an in-depth data analysis, such as Gerard Dumanil and Dominique Levy. But the other reason I focused on the U.S. is that it was the epicenter of the crisis. It became a worldwide crisis because it started in the U.S. and spread. So in terms of what happened in the U.S., overall, there was no fall in employees' share of corporate output. So there was no rise in the profit share of corporate output. There was a definite increase in inequality, which seems to be largely due to globalization, the move of heavy industry out of the industrial Midwest to the south of the United States, abroad, and so forth, smashing of some unions or give back contracts, loss of seniority rights, and so forth. So some parts of the working class really did suffer in that process that really took place, you know, in the late 1970s and into the 1980s. And inequality among workers, among wage earners, has increased. Those who have more education have been doing a lot better. Those without much formal education, only high school graduates or males with less than 4 years of college, they haven't been doing so well. But if you look at employees as a whole, they haven't suffered at the expense of profits.
How is the capitalist class doing then, if the workers are still getting the same share of output?
Well, yeah, from about 1970 to through 2007, right before the recession, the worker's share of net output was stable. The profit share of net output was therefore stable. That's a share of the output. But what capitalists care about is not profit as a share of output. They care about profit as a percentage of the amount of money that they've invested, or in other words, the rate of profit, and as we've talked about, that fell. There's the capitalist share of output or profit, and the worker's share of output or employee compensation. Both shares of output were basically flat, both of them, from 70 to 07. But the rate of profit fell because the rate of profit is not profit as a percentage of output. Okay, it's profit as a percentage of the amount of money that's been invested.
So what has happened to investment over this period then? How has HIT responded to this?
It fell as well. Over the long haul, there was pretty much the same percentage drop in the rate of profit of U.S. corporations and in their rate of investment or capital accumulation. To be technical about the latter, the rate of accumulation is the new investment as a percentage of the existing capital investment. So that new investment as a percentage of existing capital investment fell by about 40-45% between 1948 and 2007. And that's almost exactly the same as the fall in U.S. corporations' rate of profit, either with a rather inclusive or a rather narrow measure of profit being used.
So this rate of accumulation then, is the way to understand this then as thinking of the entire stock of all the capital in an economy and at what rate this big massive stock of capital of buildings and machineries is growing slowly each year? Is this what we understand as the rate of accumulation?
Yes, it's the percentage rate of increase in the stock of capital.
And so as we see the rate of profit declining, we see the amount of money that's available then to invest it back into this, increasing this rate of accumulation, this increasing this size of this stock of capital is diminishing.
That's right. I mean, one very simple way of understanding at least part of the link whereby a fall in the rate of profit leads to a fall in capital accumulation is that profit is the basis for new investment, as you said. And if, to make it even more concrete, if the same percentage of profit gets plowed back into new investment, then the rate of accumulation will fall by the same percentage that the rate of profit falls. And that is pretty much what happened over the long haul from 1948 to 2007. There has been a massive increase in the percentage of U.S. corporations' profit that gets paid out in dividends to shareholders. From the early 90s onward, there's been a very, very large increase in the payout of dividends as a percentage of profit.
Is this affecting then the amount of money that's left for investment?
Yes and no. It definitely affects the amount of profit that is left over for investment. Also, in the beginning of the 1980s, going back into the 70s as well, you had rising interest rates. So a bigger share at that point of profit got paid out in the form of interest, leading to less left over for capital investment. So those two things together, rising interest payments, rising dividends payments as a share of profit, left less profit left over for capital investment. However, corporations borrow as well. So they gain additional funds for everything by means of borrowing, either by issuing bonds or getting bank loans or tapping other sources like commercial paper market. So in fact, what happened is that even though they were paying out more in dividends and interest, and there's also stock buybacks, even with all of this, the percentage of profit of U.S. corporations that went into new productive capital investment, that didn't decline, at least through 2001. And then it gets kind of tricky to say what was happening thereafter.
So what we see then is that the workers are getting the same share of output. The capitalists are getting the same share of output, but they're withdrawing some of their share in the form of dividends, and a combination of having to pay less interest on the corporation's debt and also an increase in their corporation's debt is allowing the capitalist class then to use that dividend money to speculate on asset prices. And it's this speculation on asset prices which has helped to drive a lot of the inequality, since they're pushing money in to drive up assets that the rich already own. Is this correct?
I think that's partly correct. I think that most of the speculation, most of the increased involvement, both of people and of companies in financial markets, is driven, though, by credit. Not the use of past profits, but the creation of new means of buying stocks, buying whatever, through borrowed money.
So this rise in inequality, we think, is driven by the increase in the overall debt level in the economy.
No, there are two issues. I would say, for instance, we see people who own shares of stock. They've done a lot better. That's because of rising dividend payments. People who lend, they've done a lot better. That's because of rising interest payments and so forth. Does that mean that profits have gone up? No, not relative to the total size of the output. Workers' share hasn't fallen relative to the size of the output. It's just been the case prior to the recession that a bigger portion of that profit got paid out in the form of dividends and interest. So the rich people, the owners of property, they did well, but their rising share came at the expense of the retained profits, retained by the companies themselves. It did not come at the expense of a fall in employees' share. And then there is the issue of the investment funds available to companies. That comes from profit. That comes from also borrowing. So the companies managed to keep up their productive investment despite paying out more dividends, paying out more interest. They managed to keep up their productive investment by borrowing. And I think it's also the borrowing that has largely fueled the growth of the stock market, the growth of the bond market, the growth of all of this, all of the speculation, the bubbles, you know, that whole process that we've been seeing.
What I'm trying to get at, I suppose, here is to try and understand if the same two classes are getting the same share of output, but the inequality is increasing, it must mean somehow that then not output that's driving the inequality, but the relative price of the assets that these different classes own.
I don't really know the answer to that, because that would require, I think, being able to link income, which is a flow of money, to wealth or assets, which is an existing stock of money. That's not easy to do. But let me give you an example. I have to use rather rough figures. Let's say that the value of what's produced by the business sector is 100 and it remains the same. And the employees get 62 of that 100. Then there's 38 in profit. And at first, of that 38 in profit, let's say 23 goes for dividend payments and interest payments. Okay, 15 is left over. Okay, that 15 is profit that the companies themselves hold, that they can use for fixed capital investment, they can use for company picnics, they can do whatever with. Okay, but then the dividend payments rise, the interest payments rise, the workers are still getting 62, the profit is still 38. Okay, but now let's say the dividends and the interest payments come to 30. Instead of 23, so what's left over is only 8. The companies themselves are only keeping 8 of that 100 or 8 of that 38 for new investment and so forth.
Okay, so what we're saying here is that the amount that's extra that's being paid out in the dividend is really what we're saying is increasing the inequality. It's because the capitalist is taking it for themselves and not leaving it in the corporation.
That's part of it, yes. And the other part is increasing inequality among workers. Better paid workers, wages and benefits have increased much faster than lower paid workers. Workers with more formal education, their pay has gone up much faster than has the pay of workers with less formal education.
So within the working class, the stratification of the wages is diverging.
Yes.
Well, Andrew, thanks very much for coming on the show again.
Well, thank you very much, Tom, for inviting me, for all of the really stimulating questions. I'm just too bad about the technical problems we've been having.
This episode, you heard the theme tune, The Order of the Pharaonic Jesters, by Sun Ra and his orchestra, and the Beatles singing Hello, Goodbye. You also heard the Girls of Heim falling, and you are now listening to John Mouse's Believer. Thanks for listening. Hope you join me for the next episode of From Alpha to Omega.